I just realized that I may have left my copy of the big book in my hotel room upstairs. And if I did, that's embarrassing, isn't it? Okay, well, I can use a new copy. Thank you. Yeah, I'm almost at that point. Is this microphone on and you can hear me? Is this about a it's okay?
Yeah.
Great. I'm going to start off by sending around my pictures. You will note that although I have lost quite a bit of weight, I was not morbidly obese. And I'll tell the story about I was saved about 100 pounds in OA by the intervention of a friend of mine who had been in AA. And I'll talk about that sometime this evening. Just a couple things to say about these pictures. They don't catch me at my biggest because I stopped having pictures taken of me at my biggest. Secondly, the third picture, my wife requires me to say that she never wore that dress again. She does. I mean, I'm not kidding you. There are also, after some of the fat pictures, there's a picture of me being very, very happy. It's a picture of me at Stepping Stones, which is where Bill Wilson and Lois Wilson lived from 1949 on until they died. And the kitchen table I'm sitting at is, for those of you who are big book thumpers, the kitchen table where Bill met with Abby. And then the next picture is the desk that Bill wrote most of AA literature on. If you look close, you can see the cigarette burns. The next desk, for those of you who may be in Al-Anon or interested in the history of AA, is Lois's desk. And you'll note that there's a three-tiered I forgot what you call them, but the tiers where you put files and things to do. And they're labeled first things first. The middle one is easy does it. And the bottom one is live and let live, which I think is very good. There's also a picture of the letter from Dr. Carl Jung, which I'll be discussing tomorrow, imperfectly framed by Lois. And then there is a picture of the third version of the gravestone. Many of them have been... at least the second version of the gravestone, which actually Bill talks about on the first page of the big book, was almost certainly destroyed by a whole bunch of people rubbing it, making rubbings out of it. So I'll just pass that on, and when it comes to the end, please bring it to me at the end of this session. I want to thank you, as I'll make clear on Sunday when I talk about step 12. Doing these is one of the great privileges of my life, and I very much appreciate being asked to do this, and I just have, it's just such a privilege. I get more out of it maybe than you will, and I mean that. Whatever you do with it, it's one more piece of insurance at my at my ability to keep away from the food ingredients and eating behaviors that I've identified as things I have to abstain from. I know that there are at least three people in this room who've never heard me before, and I'm really glad for that, because I would get very tired of listening to myself. My name is Laurie. I'm a compulsive overeater. I first said those words on February the 11th, 1986, when I joined my first OA meeting. I got to that in this way. I am a three-time lifetime member of a popular weight loss program. I've been fat my entire remembered life. There are pictures of me when I was younger in which I was thin, but certainly I remember being fat all my life. I grew up, unlike a lot of us in OA, I grew up in a very loving and secure household, privileged in many, many ways. Too much food, that was, not too much love, but too much food. I joke, but I think it's generally a true statement, that almost every ethnic group except the British, have the experience of eat, it's good for you, food is love. And the British, quite wisely, because their food is so bad, don't have that. I actually told that joke in England once, and I got a good response. And yeah, they know. They can taste it. And so all my life, and I've been on all the diets, not all of the crazy ones, but many of them. I'm a skeptical kind of person, so I didn't go on some of the crazy ones, but I certainly went on some that in retrospect were crazy, even though they seemed reasonable to me at the time. And I never, I'd lose weight, then gain it, and lose and gain it. I joined a popular weight loss program, and I lost the weight. They gave me back the foods that I had given up during the diet. This was back in the 70s when it was not a bad diet. And but over a period of time, I gained all the way back and more. Redoubled my efforts, lost the weight, gave me back my foods, gained it all back again and more. And the third time, even more. I am now retired from the practice of law, so I don't have to apologize for being a lawyer. But I was a lawyer for many years, and in my first 8 years, 10 years, I was working in a workaholic law firm. And my kids were born, our kids were born about 5 or 6 years into that. And I realized that I was becoming sort of upset by their presence because they were interfering with the work I was doing. And I knew that that was wrong. I actually went to a counselor and I started to work with a counselor. And I came to the conclusion that my problems, all my problems, including my weight and my eating, had to do with all the stress I had and all the difficulties I was having trying to juggle what I wanted to, not just the duty I owe to our girls, but also what I wanted to be with them, and juggle that with my professional obligations. So I left that firm and I set up a small sort of little boutique firm in a low rent area. It was a mile and a half away from where I lived, and it had a sauna and a shower in the building. And I was going to run to work and shower, maybe even sauna, and run home, and that would solve my obesity and all my problems. It's around the time that many of those pictures were taken. Well, I instead gained even more weight, and as a matter of fact, I never ran to work. I never took a shower in that building. I certainly never took a sauna. And I was gaining weight and splitting my already oversized pants. And into my life came a very old friend of my wife's and mine, actually the guy. He passed away a few years ago, but he was responsible for the only two life-changing decisions I've ever made. One was marrying my wife, and he certainly encouraged us to see past our differences and that we really were meant for each other, and we certainly seem to have been. And the other was joining OA, and he had been in AA for, at that time, maybe 30 years. He had been a gutter drunk at the age of 14. He was very big for his age and looked adult and acted adult. Then he was rescued by some hardcore AA people who themselves had been gutter drunks and brought into AA and had really prospered and had gone from being a grade 9 dropout to a PhD, making good money. I mean, just an amazing man. He was my mentor in many, many ways. Many, many ways. Like a big brother to me and like a big brother to my wife. He had left Winnipeg, my hometown, which is, for your interest, directly north of Fargo and Grand Forks. So right in the middle of Canada, or right in the latitudinal middle of Canada, not the longitudinal. I think I'm right, longitudinal middle. He came back to visit. And he came to visit me in my new low-rent office, and where everything was supposed to be wonderful, but it wasn't. And my pants size was either 42 or 44 split. I mean, that's... because I was splitting my pants. And I said, I think I'm going to have to go back to that, the weight loss program, because my wife is no enabler, and she was saying, you're killing yourself. I have, in my family, I have diabetes on 3 out of my 4 grandparents' side, and those 3 all died of diabetes. The other one died of high blood pressure and heart disease. And I, That's not quite true. I'm trying to work it out. But anyway, a lot of diabetes and heart problems and high blood pressure problems in my family. And of course, my obesity was leading to a death, as it does for all of us who have problems with compulsive eating, a death by a thousand cuts. You know, it's not going to be the dramatic sudden cut. Well, maybe. Maybe we'll be lucky enough to have a killer heart attack, as it were. But generally, it'll be strokes. It'll be the slow cutting off of literally sometimes our limbs or our mobility, our eyesight, our ability to breathe, our ability to our joints. I mean, all of these things, whether we undereat or overeat, this is the fate that comes to us from compulsive eating. It's not as dramatic as drug addiction, alcohol addiction, even gambling addiction. It is slow and painful and demeaning and debilitating. Anyway, my wife could see that, and she was saying, you gotta do something about it, you gotta do something about it. I knew I had to do something about it, because I had no more excuses, because I was now working, you know, 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, no workaholic life, the overhead was low, everything was supposed to be really great, and it was great in my work life, and my family was happy, and I was eating, 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 and eating. So my friend visits me in my office, and I said, you know, my wife's making me to go back to that other program, that other diet. He said, why don't you try OA? I said, what's OA? He said, Overeaters Anonymous. I said, what's that? He says, it's just like Alcoholics Anonymous, except it's for overeaters. And I said, you know, Wally, never in my life have I ever had a business appointment on a Thursday, eaten a donut on a Wednesday, and woke up in a hotel room on Friday not knowing where I'd been. And those were his stories. I mean, those were his stories and the stories of all the other wonderful people I met through him who were in AA, whom I admired. I mean, they were deep, compassionate people who spoke from such a wealth of suffering with so much hope and so much love and so much giving and caring for others. I wanted to be like them. I don't like to drink. Alcohol makes me kind of sick. Certainly, you know, these days, half a glass of wine can just make me feel sick. I like the taste. I don't like what it does to me. And he didn't laugh. And he said, if you don't start taking your food as seriously as I take my alcohol, you're going to die. And his saying that, I believe, saved me at least 100 pounds, because it was very hard to take food as seriously as alcohol. I knew what alcohol did to my friend and to the people that, who told me their stories. I knew the drunkenness and the, you know, blacking out and the, you know, the literal take a drink on a Wednesday and you wake up in a hotel room on a Friday. I understood all that. I had never had that. I had always been successful in whatever work I had. Through all my eating, I had a loving family. It just didn't seem to be as serious. And his telling me I had the right to treat it seriously gave me a life that I never thought I could have. When I speak to a newcomer, and I say to the newcomer, I can watch people eat all the foods I used to binge on and not want to eat them. I can watch my wife bite into a dessert brought on a trolley in a fancy restaurant, and she picks the most chocolatey, rich thing that she can buy. And she bites into it, and she goes, oh, it's so good. I can watch her and be happy for her and not want it. And not only can I watch it and be happy for her, even if she offered me a bite, I would not want to try it. And furthermore, and I say this to newcomers, if they'll listen to me, when she stops halfway through that thing and says, oh, I'm full, I can't eat another bite, I no longer get angry at her. And I say to the newcomers, that's a miracle for me. You know, ice cream goes bad in the freezer, and I don't care, nor do I try and scrape it off and eat it as I used to. I've eaten tubs of ice cream. I've eaten jars of peanut butter. You know, the amount of buttered popcorn I've eaten, or even fake buttered popcorn, which is disgusting, but the amount I've eaten, is incredible. And not to want to have that is the miracle. Because I saw that in my friends, in my alcoholic friends, my AA friends. I remember being taken his story was an amazing, amazing story of degradation and, you know, elevation. And my friend, my friend took me to visit this guy in his apartment, and we were sitting around, it was an afternoon, I still remember, he says, Laurie, you want a beer? I mean, he wasn't going to offer it to Wally, and I said, yeah. So he opens his refrigerator, stocked full with beer, nothing else in it. He ate out all the time. But in those days, AA people would have beer to taper people off, the drunks off, to keep them from getting, you know, the DTs and things like that. And that man could have beer in his apartment and not want to drink it. And that's what I'm like with the foods that I've abstained from. Now, that's the kind of miracle that my friend was able to promise to me. It didn't happen to me. It happened to me right away. I got a sponsor. I lost weight. I got abstinent. I worked the steps with my sponsor. He sponsored me to the best of his ability. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. I lost weight. I remember I was able to take a meeting, my first meeting in my third month. And I really was visibly losing quite a bit of weight and full of this sense of recovery. I think I'd probably already done steps 4, 5, 6, 7, maybe even 8. I remember saying at the meeting when I took it, apologizing because I did not have a suffering life as so many of the people in the program I had met in this meeting had. I called that meeting, in retrospect, a soap opera meeting because you keep coming back every week to find out, did he break up with his girlfriend? Did she tell the foreman where to go, you know, and stuff like that? Did he finally have that talk with the parents? You know, it was full of recovery, but it was that kind of a meeting with people who had really had really hard lives. And I felt really out of place in that respect because I really did have a very loving and secure and privileged life. And so I apologized. And I told my story and went around the room, and one of the long timers, AA as well as OA, said in the meeting, you might consider this crosstalk, but it sure was good. He said, you know, Laurie, from those of us who have been in the gutter, you haven't missed a thing. And he was right, of course, because what makes us compulsive eaters has nothing to do with how much or how little we've suffered. Believe me, I'm dramatic enough to have suffered a lot, even though I haven't suffered at all. You know, the little slights that I've had, they've caused me great pain. At least they did. I felt that they caused me great pain in my life. I mean, I look back and they were so little compared to what's happened to so many other people. But so what brings us together is the sense of being compulsive eaters. And I want to go through that. I want to talk about the big book and how it applies and how it can apply to OA. I invite you to go to a website, www.oabigbook, all one word, oabigbook.info, I-N-F-O. You will find, it's just one page. Well, you're given a choice. Your first click is whether you want to go to the oa.org website, or if you're at all interested in the big book in OA, click on the next page. And then you're on a page which has a whole bunch of downloads, some of which will be passed out tomorrow. There's also a book there that's available for you to download. It's all free, PDF downloads, and some podcasts if you're at all interested in hearing, I don't know why, well, and hearing something like what I'm doing now. I'm going to be talking to you about the big book, and I want to stress a few things. One is, I have been schooled and trained in textual analysis and teaching. So I have a pretty good ability to convey what I've learned from the big book in a way that I hope will convey to you a way in which you might recover if you need to recover from compulsive eating. But I am not a guru, and I am not a poster child for OA. I am one bite away from compulsively eating. I have a day-to-day recovery. It's contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And sometimes my spiritual condition isn't as good as other days. And sometimes I have difficulties. And I don't want you to think that I am anything more than just one member of OA. People who come up to me and tell me how wonderful I am, it's awfully nice of you to, some of you who already just did that. But you know what? I can't afford to feel big. In either my ego or my body. I can't afford it anymore. So I'm, and that is tied to something else. I have studied the work of giants. Joe and Charlie. Two Joes, one Charlie. One Joe retired, Charlie got another Joe. The great AA, he did. The great AA speakers who brought the big book alive to thousands and thousands and thousands of AAers and OAers. They did workshops for OA as well. I attended an AA big book study they did in my hometown of Winnipeg. I've listened to 6 or 7 of their tapes. I've read a transcript of one of their lengthiest podcasts or one of their lengthiest workshops. I've read their books. I've studied them. And then I've also had the privilege of having attended a big book workshop given for OA, as well as listening to tapes, I'll talk about that in a second, given by a guy in my hometown who counted Charlie as his sponsor. Charlie and Joe's have all passed away, who I think stood on the shoulders of Joe and Charlie and went a bit more simpler, actually a bit simpler. And he developed some of the forms and the methods of doing step 4 that I'll be sharing with you tomorrow. His name is Blaine. Still alive, although not feeling very well. And he's given me permission to use his forms, and although he's been ill, I've had the opportunity of telling him that thousands and thousands of people in OA have used them with so much recovery, and to thank him for that. I don't know whether anything I'm going to tell you, other than my own story, is original with me. Every so often I say something and I say, wow, that's brilliant. And then 5 years later I read the book that I saw it actually came from, you know. So I don't want to take any credit for what I say. I am telling you what I've been taught. And I'm so privileged to do that. The big book was written basically it was written mostly by Bill Wilson, but agreed to and edited and a lot of work done by under 40, 50 people within AA and with suggestions from psychologists and some religious figures, which were incorporated from the original draft into the book that we have today. Aside from a few changes in the first 164 pages, the first 164 pages have remained intact. It is a book, take it as a book of the fellowship at the time as it was just beginning. It is a book written basically by white Christian males. That's basically what it is. Who, at a time when women were the little girl at home, or the girls at home, it is hard, and using language that Bill was taught in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that has sometimes a biblical aspect to it. Certainly the words used are sometimes old-fashioned, and sometimes the words don't mean the same thing that they mean now. It is sometimes, and it was written by people who were victimizers, who did bad things and feel bad about them and wanted to make atonement for the things that they did to their wives and to their families and to their co-workers and the people around them. The vast majority of us in OA are women. The vast majority of us, at least anecdotally speaking, of us have had difficult at times and have at many times been victims and not victimizers. To us, while alcohol may be a stimulant to the alcoholics, they talk about all the great good times and the, you know, all the boisterous times and all that. For us, our eating or undereating has been isolating. And whether you eat, overeat or undereat, basically it's anesthetic. You are lethargic. You don't move very much. Whereas, even though, I mean, alcohol is an absolute anesthetic for me, but it's a stimulant, apparently, to a lot of alcoholics. So the stories in the big book and the way in which it was written and the fact that so many of us want to read it and say, why doesn't he read it? You know, or he should have read it, or you know what I'm saying, like, you know, my partner should have read it, or something like that. It's so hard to read at times. And yet, it hasn't been changed because no one wants to change it. Somehow, whatever its flaws, there's a brilliance to it. Those of you who are religious, you'll find out that I am absolutely not religious, many of you will consider it God-inspired. I certainly consider it to be an artistic work that's as inspired as some great work of literature, in which you will find a consistency within sentences and with the whole book. There's an infusion of consistency so that you'll read a sentence here and you'll see that whole theme repeated in other parts of the book quite consistently. Joe and Charlie were brilliant at bringing that out, and I'm going to give you a lot of what they've taught me, not personally, but what I've learned from them. If you have recovered and have the ability to say, as I can say, that for over 25 years I have not been tempted by the foods, food ingredients, and eating behaviors that would cause me compulsive cravings, that I have abstained from, that I haven't been tempted by them for over 25 years. If you can say that you're in that state of not being tempted, so that then that you've worked the steps of Overeaters Anonymous to that point, then I'm not going to suggest to you that you should change how you do it. Many of the mentors I have in this program have worked the steps without using the big book, or have used it as a book that has a lot of really wonderful quotes in it, but they've worked the steps in other ways. And I consider many of my mentors who have done that to be far more spiritual than I am. They certainly have lost a lot more weight than I have. They have had harder lives than I have, and yet they've overcome that and are incredible mentors to me. So who am I to say that the big book is the only way to work the steps? It clearly isn't. It's the original way. Well, it's actually not even the original way. It's the way in which all the AAers at the time agreed was a proper method that could be conveyed for people who did not have anyone from AA around to give them advice or to sponsor them. Because at the time this book was published, AA was confined to three cities: New York City, Akron, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio. That was it. There were a couple of AAers who would travel, salesmen. There was one woman at the time, this out of approximately 100, there's one woman in AA at the time. So they set out to write a book and to have a book published that gave directions that could be followed without anyone around to help them. And thus it's a very valuable document because it provides relatively clear. Need some clarification, need some pointers. Joe and Charlie did that, sort of a sense of where things are structured, how the book is structured, but basically directions for working the steps. If you want what I've been given and what thousands and thousands of us in OA have been given and what millions and millions of us in 12-step fellowships around the world have been given, this ability to be around what we were addicted to and not wanted, and if you have worked the steps and that hasn't happened to you, try this. It's worth it. And whether you have recovered or not, many of the things that you'll find in the big book will certainly challenge what you know about OA and can be quite provocative and are worthwhile looking at to see whether or not they might give you an insight into yourself and your own way of carrying the program. I've developed, because we like 12 in our program, 12 provocations, 12 provocative statements, which the first time I unveiled these was in Maine at a retreat far away from it was quite a civilized retreat, so I can't say it was far away from civilization, but far away from any town. And I unveiled them, and someone came up to me on a Friday night, and someone came up to me on a Sunday, said, you know, if I hadn't paid for the whole weekend, I'd have left right after you read those things. They're so offensive. I've tried to tone them down a bit, but somewhere in OA, someone will take offense at one or more of these statements. So I'm going to read them because I think the Big Book stands for these propositions, and they might, and I will prove them, at least I think I will prove them to your satisfaction, not that you'll agree with them, but that you'll see that the Big Book stands for them by the time Sunday comes along, and I'll summarize and point out where they've been proven. And you can find all this in the book that's available for download on that website. First of all, I am a recovered compulsive overeater, not a recovering one. Second, abstinence is not the most important thing in my life without acceptance. The consciousness of the presence of my higher power is. Third, although a sponsor, if available, is very important for recovery, a sponsor is not necessary to recover. You can't get away with the excuse, oh, I can't find a sponsor that's right for me, so I guess I'll just wait until I find a sponsor. You don't need a sponsor to work the steps. Sure, a sponsor would be helpful, but you don't need one. And the Big Book actually stands for that proposition because it was written for people who didn't have sponsors available for them. Fourth, you can recover in weeks. Forget about, oh, you don't do step four until you've been, in the program for a year, which you hear in a number of programs, actually. That can kill you. Big Book keeps pushing you and pushing you to more and more action. Five, the tools of recovery are not an essential part of the OA program. They are a method of keeping abstinent while you're working the program, but they're not going to get you recovery. Six, you don't take steps one and two. Seven, steps three, six, seven, and eight should not take a long time to get through. We'll see that the Big Book pushes us. After we do step five, six, seven, eight, and nine, well, nine has begun, but six, seven, and eight are done within a day, 2 days, 3 days, tops. You know, we're used to the 12 and 12s, the AA 12 and 12, the Al-Anon 12 and 12, the NA 12 and 12, the OA 12 and 12, and each one of them gives approximately the same number of pages to each step. And we sort of think, well, each step requires the same amount of time. But as we look at the history of the 12 steps, and we find out that there were only six to begin with, and that the other six were put in just as moments in time to make sure you didn't leave anything out, you'll see how quickly the steps can be done. The longest step is step four. And that shouldn't take a lot of time if you do it the Big Book way. Eight, you don't make amends to yourself. There's a big one. First person I have to make amends to is myself. Well, not from the Big Book perspective. I'll tell you, you make amends to yourself by transforming yourself by making amends to others. That's the amend you make to yourself. Nine, you cannot carry the message until after you've completed step nine, because that's where the guarantees of this program come. 10, and I used to hear this all the time, it was a slogan within OA, service is not slimming. And I proved it. For years, I proved it with my 7 years of relapse. 11, food can be discussed at meetings. Are there meetings that you're aware of in the GSI that you can't mention food? Yeah? Well, not the Big Book. Big Book suggests that that should not be a problem, and I don't know how many of you are in AA, but I can't imagine an AA meeting in which someone said, and then I took a drink of a brown fizzy liquid. Just can't imagine it. I don't know how, I'm going to tell you stories about my eating behaviors. I don't know how to tell those stories without mentioning foods. And 12 is the most provocative, and I'll be spending time on that on Sunday for the most part when I discuss mostly step 12. Every person who wants to be a member of OA should know exactly what it means to have a desire to stop eating compulsively. Because if you don't know what it means, that's what defines membership, a desire, you know, tradition three. Everyone who wants to stop eating compulsively is a member. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. Well, what does that mean? If you don't know what it means, then if you just have a desire just to lose weight, that's not the same thing as a desire to stop eating compulsively. So defining what it means to be a compulsive eater is the responsibility of our meetings so that someone who joins our meetings knows exactly what the responsibility he or she has to that meeting. I'll talk about that as we go on. That's very provocative. Okay?
What was step 11?
Number 11? Food can be discussed at meetings.
Is this your opinion?
These are, well, it's my belief that you will find all of these 12 concepts in the big book, through the big book. Okay?
What was the one about you can't carry the message unless you've done 9?
You finished step 9.
Right?
Yeah. 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 As the big book says, you clearly cannot carry that which you do not have. The guarantees of this program come at step 9. Guarantees of recovery come at step 9. There was a great comedian, he's still alive, Mort Saul, I don't think he does any, but he used to do political comedy, and he used to end his sessions with, "Is there anyone else here I haven't offended?" Anyone I haven't offended yet? So these are the provocations. And I mention them here, and I try to show them as we go along in our journey through the 12 steps. I mention them here simply to open your mind, not to close it. Simply to see that the big book has a lot that we can learn from, whether or not we do the steps exactly the big book way. I am a big book thumper. I know the arcane things about which printing and which years of printing had the typographical errors, where the word "for" instead of was used, where the you know that it's forgotten. I could tell you these things. I know how many steps there were on Dr. Bob's house. Guess 12. I've touched a board that belonged to the steps, the old porch. I know all those things, and I'm a big book thumper in that respect. But I am not one who says that the only way to work the steps is the big book way. That would be false and wrong. And I'm going to talk about that when we talk about sponsoring. One size fits all is not the way we should be sponsoring. And the big book makes that clear as well. You know, there's all the way through OA, there are people who will be more than happy to say, "I will only sponsor you if you adopt my plan of eating. I will only sponsor you if you do the steps exactly the way I want you to do the steps. You have to answer these X number of questions, or you have to do this, or you must take this long to do this." Different people learn at different ways, and different people learn at different paces. The big book, I think, stands for the proposition, and I welcome that proposition, that we've got to be flexible. We're here to help those who still suffer. And they're not here to suffer from us. Okay. With all that in mind, I want to tell my story, and then I want to start working, looking at the big book. It all started in the 5,000-watt radio station. How old is that? No one remembers. Oh, God. You'll find when I talk about sex conduct in step 4 that I was obsessed with Mary Tyler Moore. And that's Ted Baxter used to tell the story. It all started with the 5,000-watt radio station. Well, that's the first of my jokes that's fallen flat. And as I love to say, I may not stop the show, but I sure do slow it down. That's a joke. As I said, I was heavy for a long time, and I'm going to tell you my stories, my eating stories, along two particular lines to make the point that the big book makes about how to define our addiction. My compulsive eating can be summarized by a visual of my hand bringing food to my mouth and continuing to bring food to my mouth and my mind saying, I've got to stop. The next bite will be the last. No, the next bite, and the hand keeps bringing the food to the mouth. Often, sometimes it will be a fork or a spoon bringing the food to the mouth. Sometimes it should be a fork and spoon or spoon, but it's my hand bringing it to the mouth. And the mouth just keeps taking it in, and my mind is saying, I've got to stop, and I can't stop. But I have two other stories, and they are disgusting. But they are indicative of the kind of eating that I did. I am Jewish. I am a secular Jew. I have no religious background. I mean, I know a lot about the religion, but I don't practice it. But my family celebrated the Jewish holidays, not the holy days, but the holidays. You know what they say about Jewish holidays? They are basically, we were oppressed, we beat them, let's eat. You know, that's certainly Passover, Hanukkah, Purim. Anyway, Hanukkah is the winter solstice festival, the festival of lights. It comes around approximately the same time as Christmas, depending on the moon calendar, lunar calendar, rather than the Georgian calendar. But the it's a time it commemorates the taking back of the Great Temple and the time by guerrilla warfare actually. From the, I can't remember who owned it at the time or who had taken it. But anyway, it was taken back by the Jews, and they wanted to relight the eternal flame, which had been desecrated. And there was only enough oil to burn the flame for one day, and it would take them 8 days to make the oil to keep the flame going. But a miracle occurred, and the flame lasted for 8 days. So that's why Hanukkah is 8 days. That's the myth. So it is a festival of lights. And that's why we have the menorahs, you know, the eight thing with menorahs, if you've ever seen them. It's also a festival of grease, because the oil is the theme. And all the food, for those of you who may have eaten Hanukkah dinner, will recognize that the food is as greasy as it can be. Deep-fried pancakes called latkes. Goose is often the meal. Goose is the fattest domesticated bird you can eat. And it was Hanukkah dinner, I don't know how many years ago, my mother, my father, 10 other guests, and I were at this dinner in my old house. And I had eaten more than I could possibly have eaten. I had eaten it all that food. I mean, not only do you have these deep-fried pancakes, but you also put sour cream on them to, you know, I mean, just you can't imagine the amount of fat in that stuff. Anyway, I walked, this to show you how long ago it was, I walked into the kitchen to get a tab. So how long ago was tab? A diet drink, right? That was the first diet drink, so it was a long time ago. I've always loved the irony of that, you know. And I walk in, and there on the cutting board is the carcass of the goose with the skin draped on it. The skin is so fat that it actually slips right off the bird. It doesn't stick like turkey skin or chicken skin. It actually just slips right off. And I remember saying to myself, I really like goose skin, but I am stuffed. I'm so stuffed. I'll have a little bite. So I picked up this skin, very hot. An hour and a half after being taken out of the oven, it was so fat that it still was hot. And I tried to take a little bite out of it, and it's a very tough skin. I couldn't do it. So I pushed a bit more in to try and find a weak spot. I couldn't do it. Pushed a bit more in. And I must say, I might have blacked out because all I remember is it was completely in my mouth. It was burning the inside of my mouth. I was chewing frantically because of the burning. The fat was spurting and dripping out of my mouth. You know, people were 10 feet away around the corner. If any one of them had come in, it would have been so humiliating. I didn't stop until I swallowed. I couldn't bite the skin. I swallowed it whole. And I was stuffed already. That's one story. That's pretty disgusting. The next one is really disgusting. I was lucky enough to go to a very nice college south of Minneapolis for 4 years in the 60s. And it was spring break, and I come back from spring break. So it's March, end of March. And there was an overnight train that used to go between Winnipeg and Minneapolis. And I was on that train. It arrived at 6 in the morning, and the bus to go back to my college on a Sunday morning left at 8. So I had 2 hours. I just wandered about Minneapolis. Those of you who know Minneapolis may remember Hennepin in the 60s. Well, I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Hennepin in the 60s. But it was a pretty down-and-out. It was the main street. It was the down-and-out place. So I was wandering about the distance, you know, between the train station and the bus station. Was around Hennepin. So I'm wandering about. This dismal, gray, dark day. I'd already had a breakfast on the train of consisting of, I don't know what, but I'd already had a breakfast. And I walked by this diner that's obviously a 24-hour diner, you know, two eggs, coffee, hash browns, sausage, you know, toast, 39 cents or something like that. 1963. So I walk in, and it's full of smoke, and it's full of people coughing and hacking. I obviously had been on benders, and they were just sort of sitting in there, you know, and it's packed. And I find one seat at the counter, and I order this 39-cent special, and it's greasy, and it's awful, and I'm gobbling it down. The man beside me suddenly vomits, and it goes completely over onto his plate. Then he passes out, and his head goes right into that mixture. I gotta tell you, my wife has never heard that story, and she's never heard a tape of mine. If she ever heard it, she couldn't eat for 4 days, or for 4 hours. You know what I mean? What did I do? I kept on eating. Now, there's a sickness there that goes beyond my mental abilities. What caused me not to be able to stop when I was stuffed to the gills with a goose? When I was given this disgusting thing? I mean, when all this food comes in, I'm saying, this is the last bite. What could prevent my mind from controlling myself? That was a mystery to me. I remembered the stories, but I never understood that. And then here are the other stories. Actually just one story, and then I'll give you lots of examples. I lived in Chicago for a year on very little money. I was on a scholarship, and I didn't spend a lot of money. I didn't have a lot of money, and I didn't eat a lot. And I walked everywhere. So I was in better shape than I'd ever been. Thinner than I'd ever been. Still thought I was fat, but thinner than I'd ever been. And I came home after that year to the loving bosom of my family, with my grandmother thinking that I was sick and dying because I wasn't plump anymore. And I said to myself, you know, I'm thin enough now, and I'm home, and there's money, and there's food available. I'm going to have bananas with cream. Now, bananas with cream, I thought was my own invention. Maybe it is. It's you slice up a banana, and then you pour cream to the top of the bowl, and then you pour sugar on top of that until it reaches above the top of the bowl. Then you quickly eat the bananas, and then you gradually just mix the sugar and the cream together. I said, not just half and half cream, not just cereal cream. It's going to be English Devonshire cream. It's 90% fat. You shake it in the, it comes in cans, you shake it, it turns into butter. And not quite, but it's like that. So I found this Devonshire cream, I put it in the fridge, and finally everything was ready, and you dollop it. You use a spoon to put it on top of the bananas. Put the sugar on. Had one bite and was sick. I hadn't had that much fat in me for a year. And I actually physically felt nauseated by the greasiness of this cream. What would a sane person do who had been fat his entire life and finally no longer wanted the things that used to beckon to him? He would say, hallelujah. What did I do? I said, I'm going to start with 1%, I'll go to 2%, I'll go to 3%, I'll go to 10%, till I can have that Devonshire cream. And that's exactly what I did, and within a year, 2 years, I was heavier than I had ever been. And this question then is, what could persuade me, despite all my best wishes, to go back to what I knew I shouldn't be doing? How could my mind play such a trick on me? And I'll give you a list of all the tricks that I've played on myself, and you can add to them yourself. I'm so depressed. What will make me feel better? I'm so happy. How can I celebrate? I didn't eat the bun. I only had one helping, so I can have the dessert. I worked so hard making it. I feel guilty because I didn't work so hard making it. No one loves me. Too many people love me. How will I fit in? I want to die. I remember this so well. I want to die and overeating will kill me, but it's a nice way to commit suicide. My wife won't feel guilty. And I remember feeling that I knew I was killing myself, but she couldn't blame herself for that. Whereas if I literally committed suicide, if I did it in a dramatic or violent way, she would be left with that guilt. They made it especially for me. How can I refuse it? It's free. I'll never be able to have this food again. The chef just died and took the recipe with him. You know, I'm in New Orleans and I have to have whatever it is that they make. What? Beignet, whatever it is. I was in New Orleans. I never had one. I don't know what they're like. Everyone is looking at me. How can I refuse? I'm standing up. It doesn't count. I don't care about that. Here's one of my favorites. It actually worked for me for a long time while I was abstinent, because I count my abstinence as being conscious of what I have to abstain from. I wasn't conscious for a while of this. It's a stone ground whole grain cinnamon bun made with organic molasses and cold pressed organic oil. It's got to be good for me, you know. She's not looking. Doesn't count. I remember this one. At least people can see what my weakness is. I'm not hiding it. And I've been good for a year. I've been good for 6 months. I've been good for a month. I've been good for a week. I've been good for a day. I've been good for 3 hours. I've been good for 2 hours. I've been good for 1 hour. I've been good for 5 minutes. And that was enough to persuade me I could have it today. I could have it right now. So here are the two mysteries. On the one hand, why is it once I started, I couldn't stop? And on the other hand, how come I couldn't stop from starting? Those are the two mysteries that, if I look back in my life, were not answered until 7 years into my being in OA. When I finally accepted, after 7 years of relapse, the simple concept of addiction that the big book has. And we'll read that in just a few moments. I want to start the big book, ask you to turn to the title page. It says Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. It doesn't say are recovering, it says have recovered. And you'll note that this was published in 1939, only 4 years after Bill Wilson, the first person to become sober with using the equivalent of the 12 steps, had become sober. And yet they spoke of have recovered. And what is recovery? They have recovered that which was lost. The title page. Right here. It says Alcoholics Anonymous. Looks like this. You recover that. What have you lost? Your sanity. The sanity that allows you to say, why would I eat this stuff? It's poison for me. That's what you've recovered from. Now, how many of you have fourth edition? How many of you have third edition? Okay. A few of you. How many have second edition? Any of you have a first edition? Here? Not here. Yeah. You have a real first edition, or you have the reprint? Yes, I have the reprint too. A real first edition would be worth a lot of money. Okay. I then ask you to turn to page XI, preface, 11 in Roman numerals. It says this is the fourth edition, or this is the third edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The first paragraph just gives you numbers, and you will see that the big book is one of the most popular books ever printed. According to Joe and Charlie, it is the second most popular hardcover book printed. I'm not sure they took into account the Quran or the thoughts of Chairman Mao. My guess is that those two hardcover books are also among the most popular books ever printed. But there's no question that over 5,000 copies a day are printed of the big book. It is a book that has never been out of print. It keeps selling, and it is very popular. The second paragraph begins, because this book has become the basic text for our society, and that theme of being the basic text is also carried out, is also found in the introduction to the AA 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, the basic text. And Joe and Charlie point out that a textbook is a book in which people who have knowledge convey it to people who don't. And it's a book that should be read in order, from chapter 1 all the way through to the chapters. You don't study algebra, Joe and Charlie point out, without first learning arithmetic. And you don't suddenly go to chapter 5 of the calculus book without reading chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and 4. And probably, if my case is any example, rereading chapters 1, 2, and 3, and 1, 2, and 3, and 1, 2, and 3, until I get to chapter 5 and when they finally explain differential calculus, which I've forgotten about completely. Okay, the next is page XIII, the forward to the first edition, 13 in Roman numerals. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, again, they're not saying are recovering, have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. This is the essential theme that you'll find throughout the big book, that our abnormality is both a mind and a body thing. It's not emotional, it's mental. And we'll see the distinction as we go further in. I'll probably discuss it more tomorrow than today. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Do what we did and you'll have what we have. That's the basic message of the foreword to the first edition. I'm going to skip the foreword to the second edition, and I'll ask you to go to page XXII. And in the second last paragraph, it's a foreword to the third edition, in the second last paragraph, right in the middle of that second last paragraph, they say the 12 steps that summarize the program may be called, I can't pronounce the, Los Doce Pasos. Is that okay? Los Doce Pasos or Les Douze Étapes in another. Pardon me? XXII, 22 in Roman numerals, the forward to the third edition.
Oh, okay.
And the second last paragraph, the one that begins the basic principles of the AA program, okay. The middle of that says the 12 steps that summarize the program. Yeah, yeah. This is an indication that the 12 steps as we read them every meeting are a summary of the program. The big book, if you will, they are the ingredients of the recipe, and the big book is the instructions for the recipe. And we'll see that sometimes a step does not convey the enormity of what has to be done or the complexity of what has to be done. This is especially true for step 10. And then those of you who have a third edition can't have this. Well, actually, we're not going to read that. But the forward to the fourth edition adds 2 pages to this introductory stuff so that the doctor's opinion is... In the fourth edition, starts at XXV, and in the third edition, starts 2 pages earlier at XXIII. Okay? So go to the doctor's opinion. Now, this doctor was Dr. William D. Silkworth. He was a man, he was called the little man who loved drunks. And he was a neurologist / psychologist / neurosurgeon, I guess in those days. He was a mind doctor, you know, and he had fallen on difficult times, and he got a job working at the Towns Hospital in New York City, which was basically a place for wealthy people to dry out. And he tried to help them, not only dry out, but try to help them keep away from alcohol. And he failed abysmally for most of them. He began to develop, and he treated, I don't know how many, thousands and thousands of drunks, 50,000 drunks over his years there. And he felt so bad because he didn't know what else he could do. But he developed some theories about alcoholism that were relatively revolutionary when he published them in 1934 or 35 in a medical journal. Didn't no one paid any attention to it. But he had come up with this theory that the alcoholic was not just sick mentally, but had a there was a physical component to the alcoholic's problem that was abnormal and that didn't appear in the normal person. And this was what he calls, we'll see, the phenomenon of craving, and I'll talk about that as we read it. But he had this theory that the alcoholic had both a physical and a mental problem. This theory was the theory that he gave to Bill Wilson, and it was the theory that Bill Wilson was able to bring to a method of reaching a spiritual awakening. I'll talk about this all probably more tomorrow than today, but it was a very significant theory. So the doctor was asked to write a preface, an introduction to this book, and the first two pages, XXV or XXIII if you're in the third edition, and the next page are basically his letter of reference. And he ends the letter of reference with saying, you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. What a letter of reference. You know, they are telling you the truth. And the reason he could say that was because he knew that these people, these men, had achieved a level of spirituality where they knew that it would kill them if they lied. And he knew that they were spiritual beings who had to tell the truth. Now that's in the small size of font, small type. Then we get three paragraphs of larger type. That's now the big book writers speaking. And here's what they say. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. They say there are no musts in our program. There are at least 60 to 65 musts in the big book that have the meaning of must. You must believe this. This must you do. There are other musts that don't have that same meaning, but at least 60 to 65 in which the big book says you must do this. And here's the first one. We must believe this. What must we believe? That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure, we are certain, that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. I read those for years. When I joined the program in 1986, we had the big book in the AA 12 and 12, and we had a book of stories, OA books of stories, and we had a collection of articles from the Lifeline magazine. That was it. And I read that, I don't know how many hundreds of times in the course of my first 7 years. I refused to accept that my body was like an alcoholic's. I refused to accept the notion that I couldn't eat everything that I wanted to eat. No diet had ever told me that. Every diet I'd ever been on, every diet I'd ever read said, once you lose your weight, you can eat everything in moderation. That's the promise they gave me. Yes, you're giving it up for a short time, but don't worry, you can have it all back as long as you eat in moderation. The diet plan that I was part of, weight loss program that I was part of, gave me a cut-off scoop of ice cream, so it's like half, like a scoop with cut-off, or a half a donut or two cookies. And every time, a week. And I, first 4 weeks, that's what I did. Maybe the fifth week, when I saw that my weight wasn't going up, I ate the night of my weighing and just before I weighed. So that was within the week, two within the week. And then the half a donut became 3/4 of a donut. And then it became a full donut. And then it became a donut and ice cream. And soon my hand with the spoon was taking the ice cream out of the tub. And I was saying, I can't stop. I can't stop. I want to stop. I don't want to believe. And my first sponsor didn't my first sponsor said, you will be able to eat moderately, and that's what I did. Every time I would lose the weight, and all my relapses, I'd get back on track, I'd go back on the diet I was on, I wouldn't eat the foods that I knew would cause me to gain weight, I lost my weight, I worked the steps, I felt great, and then I went on maintenance. And I took back all this food in moderation, and each time I did, I gained more weight back. That was my 7 years of relapse. I made another mistake. I'll get to that when I talk about step 10. But my first mistake for 7 years in this program was that I wanted to believe what everyone told me I should believe. All these experts, the nutrition experts, the nutritionists, the dietitians, the doctors, the magazines, the experts. You can eat anything in moderation, which is true for some people, true for many people, just not true for me. Now, my journey in OA in those 7 years was a journey of people enabling me. They didn't care whether I gained or lost weight. They didn't care that I was eating like a pig and going to meetings and talking with all the articulateness that a lawyer can bring, or a teacher and a lawyer can bring. They said, how are you, Laurie? And I'd said, fine. And they'd say, great, Laurie. Love to hear you talk. Until one day, and I usually save this story for Sunday, but I'll tell it now. One day, the shyest woman in the room, who told me later that she had prayed for 3 weeks before she spoke to me, came up to me in a very nice, pleasant voice, said, how are you, Laurie? I said, fine. And she looked at me and she said, I mean, really? And I must say I was slightly taken aback. And consider what my options were, okay? My first option would be a lie, so I wouldn't have done this, but it would be true for some people. I'm glad you worry about me. I'm taking medication. It's a very difficult time. Roseanne, our co-founder, the late Roseanne, once came to an OA convention and said, my metabolism has been so damaged by the cancer treatment drugs I've been taking that my doctor won't let me lose any more weight because I won't be getting sufficient nutrition. So he's forcing me to eat more, and my metabolism is in such bad shape that I have gained weight, but I am abstinent. But I just want you to know, because she felt a responsibility to explain why she had gained weight, but it was because of the treatment that she was getting. That's available to some people. Not to me, but that's available. My other option is to say, how dare you take my inventory? This is a non-judgmental program. I come here for love and understanding beyond my wildest dreams. I'm leaving. And you know what? As difficult as it might have been for me to leave, it would have been so much better for that program, for that meeting that I went to. Because I was damaging the message that meeting was conveying. I was talking with great confidence about how wonderful the steps are, when I clearly wasn't living the steps. I was gaining weight. I must say that my first sponsor, was an AA as well as OA, said to me, if any person ever gets up at an AA meeting and says, I've been drinking for the last 6 weeks, but let me tell you everything I know about step six, depending on how polite the meeting was, that person might not get to speak another word, or would be told afterwards, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. But in OA, I was being welcomed. Love to hear you talk. You talk so articulately. It's so wonderful to hear you talk. When in fact, I had nothing to talk about. I wasn't living the steps. I was talking the steps. So if I had left the meeting because someone took my inventory, it would have been good for that meeting and good for all the newcomers who would come to that meeting and whom I disillusioned. I guess it is. I guess it's a verb. But in fact, what I did was cave in. I said, I'm in terrible shape and I need help. And I wish I knew what date that was, but, she spent an hour with me after the meeting and she gave me a book that she had planned to give to a sponsee, but who hadn't come to that meeting of affirmations and told me to call her every day and write down gratitude. I mean, it started to get me thinking about where I was going, to the point that about 3 months later, I was obviously showing enough recovery of some nature that I was asked to sponsor a newcomer, a male newcomer. And I met with that male newcomer. I remember where I met with him. I mean, I remember this all very, very well, even though it's over 25 years ago. And I said, tell me about yourself. He said, well, you know, I've been in AA sober for 15 years. I said, well, you've been sober in AA for longer than I've even been in OA, let alone been abstinent in OA. So I have a lot to learn from you. How do you work the steps? He said, I read the big book. I said, oh, great, I read the big book too. No, he said, I read the big book. I said, I read the big book too. You should see my copy of it. It's got black underlining and yellow highlighting and red underlining and asterisks. And then he explained that he was a disciple of Joe and Charlie and of Blaine, this guy I talked about in Winnipeg. And that when he meant, I read the big book, he meant that he followed the directions in the big book for working the steps. So I said to him, you know what? Neither of us has recovered. You obviously need the program. You're new in OA. I've been here for 7 years. You obviously know the big book. Why don't we read the big book together? I'll study it the way you've been taught, but I'll add whatever my experience in OA is, and we can sort of help each other work the steps. Proof again, I didn't have a sponsor. I wasn't sponsoring him. I had nothing to give him other than the hope that he could teach me something and that I could teach him something. So we helped each other out, and we both worked the steps the big book way and recovered. But I remember reading these passages that I just read from, this allergy, this allergic reaction that the doctor's theory they have an allergy to alcohol interests me. And I said, I know this passage. I'm not allergic to food. I love food. It doesn't give me diarrhea. It doesn't give me hives. It doesn't give me blisters. I don't get red with it. I don't get anaphylactic shock with food. I love food. He said to me, that's not what the word means. I said, listen, I have an MA in English. I have a law degree. I have the two greatest dictionaries of the English language in my office, Century Dictionary and Oxford English Dictionary, in case you're interested. I know exactly what allergy means. He said, look it up. Look it up to see how it was used when this book was written, not how it's used now. Now it means blisters, diarrhea, you know, hives and all that. What did it mean when this book was written? I looked it up. It's a very young word. It was first used in the early 1900s. And it comes from the Greek. I don't know what Greek, but it comes from the Greek. It comes from Greek. And it means a detrimental reaction to a substance. A reaction that hurts you. And what we'll find is that the doctor's description of this detrimental reaction, this reaction that hurts you, has nothing to do with what we call an allergy today. Which is why I don't use the word allergy in talking to newcomers. Because the word doesn't have that meaning anymore of what it originally was used at. But we'll talk about what the doctor discovered. Because this was the doctor's first major theory that the big book says, the big book authors say, makes so much sense to them. This idea that we get intense, overpowering cravings at times when we indulge in certain things. This concept, this theory that's proved true for me, that once I start, I can't stop. Not always. People watching me, I can put it off for a little while, then I'll do it privately. But it doesn't always happen. It happens enough to accord with my experience. What's the value of this allergy theory? Well, the first thing right off the bat is no guilt. However we get there, it's not our fault. We react differently to food from normal people. If we accept this notion, the lack of guilt, it's not a moral problem. It is that our bodies are different. Do I feel guilty that I have to wear glasses because my eyes need glasses to be able to see clearly? Do people who don't have the function of a leg or an arm feel guilty that they don't have a function of their leg or arm? Why should they? It's a disability. And my disability is that my body reacts differently than normal people. My wife gets full, even though she considers herself a chocoholic, because she needs one square of dark, not milk, not white, but dark chocolate a day That's how she defines her chocoholism. It's not how I define it. She gets full when she eats too much. I've never been full in my life. I've been stuffed, but never full. If you know what I mean. I can always eat more. I don't know what it's like to be full. I know what it's like to be stuffed, but never full. Always, there's always room for more. So, first of all, no guilt. Second of all, the easy, obvious answer is that you abstain from that which causes you the detrimental reaction, from that which causes the problem. You must abstain from it. If you abstain from it, you won't get the cravings. That's obvious. The third for OA is really significant. You have to figure out what it is you have to abstain from, and I'll be talking about that later on today. And the fourth is that if you're a people pleaser, as I am, and as I suspect many of us are in this room, when someone offers you something that you know you can't eat, you finally have the answer to say no. No, thank you. I just found out I'm allergic to it. Why would anyone give you anything you're allergic to? Thank you for making this. I have eaten in the past, but I found out I'm allergic to it. Now, they may press you. They may say, well, what happens when you eat it? And I'll give you three possible answers. The first one is mine. I'm really glad you asked. I'm a member of Overeaters Anonymous. It's just like Alcoholics Anonymous. I found just as the alcoholic can't drink alcohol, still has to drink, but just can't drink alcohol, I can't eat certain foods without developing these abnormal cravings. And if you know anyone who has what looks like an addiction to food, I'd be so happy to talk to them. And you would do me, tell them you would do me, that they would be doing me a favor to have me talk to them. It's part of my recovery. That's what I do. Not that people do it that, ask me that often, but that's what I would do. The second is that you can say, I break out in fat. And the third comes from a sponsee of mine, my bum begins to swell. So, right at the bottom of the same page we're looking at, right, the last three lines. We're on XXVI in the fourth edition and XXIV in the third edition. So 26 in the fourth edition and 24 in the third edition. Right at the bottom it says, more often than not, it is imperative, it's necessary, that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached.
Is that pre-XXII in the fourth edition?
Well, in some fourth editions.
Okay.
It's 26.
Oh, those of you who have partial editions, it would be different.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about the full edition. Yes, you're absolutely right. Thank you. So what is it in the one that doesn't have the stories?
XXII.
Okay, thank you. And if you look at that, right at the bottom of that page, and then just go right over to the bottom of the next page. Now we've got the small font, the small type. The doctor says, right at the bottom, the last line, of course an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical, we turn the page, ought to be freed from a physical craving for liquor. Of course! And this is an indication, and I don't know any other 12-step fellowship that doesn't say this, that you gotta get abstinent. You gotta clean yourself out before you work the steps. In OA, we're so nice that we say, oh, well, maybe you can get abstinent in the middle of working the steps. Well, there are some people who may, in fact, do that. But why not do what every other 12-step fellowship in the world does? Stop it. Just stop doing it and quickly work the steps so you won't want to do it. Because that's the clear message of the big book. Stop, hang on with your white knuckles or hang on as hard as you can to your sobriety and work the steps as quickly as you can, because guaranteed by the end of step 9, you won't want to return. And if you continue to do 10, 11, and 12, you'll continue not to want to return to this stuff. So you'll be in a complete position of neutrality. And that's what all the 12-step fellowships, as far as I know, I'm not an expert on every 12-step fellowship, but that's what they say. Just stop it. If you ever want to have a great time, Bob Newhart, look at, Google Bob Newhart stop it video, and you will see a great comedic master at his best. So Bob Newhart, stop at video and just look at it. It's very funny. Okay, let's keep on going with the doctor's opinion, and then I'm going to talk about abstaining. I don't know the page number in the smaller thing, but XXVIII. It's the page that begins with the words craving for liquor, and this often requires. So the next paragraph, and just subtract two if you have a third edition. The next paragraph. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago in these articles published in, I think, 1935, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. Manifestation means the visible existence of, the showing of an allergy. And then he describes what that allergy is, what the detrimental reaction is. He calls it the phenomenon of craving. Now, phenomenon, the plural is phenomena, but phenomenon means an occurrence for which there's no explanation. So he doesn't know how, why or how this happens, but he knows that there is the existence of this craving that overpowers the ability of the mind to control the body. It's like, is it Audrey the plant in Little Shop of Horrors? More food, more blood, or whatever it is. It's this inability to stop. It's this feeling of, I just gotta have more. I don't know why. I feel so empty. It makes me feel better. It's that first moment of taking your mouth here. I'm home. I don't know if that means anything to you. It sure is my story. And you know, we have a friend who is, I'm hoping, recovering from years and years of relapse of a very horrible drug addiction. And he talks about that same thing, about in the midst of all the despair that he was feeling, the guilt and the shame, that one hit suddenly just gives him this feeling that he's home. To me, it's disgusting to think about, because drugs don't do that for me. They make me feel bad. But for him, it's the same as when I used to take this bite of ice cream. Oh, you know, there's just this sense that, and it meets my needs somehow. I mean, in a way that my wife has no understanding of. As a matter of fact, my wife hated my cooking when we got married. I did the cooking, and she hated it. It was too spicy. She came from British family. Or, God, I loved her mother with all my heart, and she was a very good pastry cook, but God, her meat was awful. But anyway, We went for dinner at my mother-in-law's and father-in-law's house about 6 months into our marriage, and my wife squealed with delight. Mum's made spring potatoes, the little potatoes that you put at the bottom of a roaster, you know, and they get all crisp on the outside and they're soft on the inside. And she started, and she hadn't had them for so long, I can't wait, and she's gobbling them up. Just gobbles, cut them in half, ate. Cut them in half, ate, 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 ate. Until there's one half left. And she cuts that half into half. And she eats the quarter and puts her fork down. And I'm looking at that one quarter potato. And very calmly and nicely I say, aren't you going to eat that? She says, I can't, I'm full. And I say, but you love it. Oh, God, do I love it. It was so good to have it. I love Mom's spring potatoes. And then I yelled, why aren't you eating it? You know? And she looked at me, she said, because I'm full. And that's my wife. I mean, she gets full. I have the same thing with alcohol. You know, for years, because of my friend, I wanted to be a member of AA, but alcohol for me, at a certain point, I don't want anymore. My body says enough. I remember a long time ago, a friend of ours had broken up. Her husband had left her, and he also left her his wine collection. And she was more, and we inherited her rather than her husband, and we were happy to do that, and to give her comfort. But she was more than happy to give away the wine. So I remember she said, take out any bottle you want. So I took out a bottle. It must have been a $100 bottle of wine. And in Canada, the dollar was worth a lot more than it is now. I had a little sip of it. Oh, I had never in my life tasted a wine that good. So I really filled the wine glass up. I started drinking it. I couldn't drink more than a third before whatever it did to me made me kind of feel bad. I didn't like what it did to me. I didn't, the taste I loved, but I didn't like what it did to me. I had with alcohol what my wife has with food. I remember talking to a group of alcoholics about my food addiction. They couldn't understand that. And I remember also talking to them about my drinking, inability to drink. They couldn't understand that either. It's like just, they don't understand. The analogies we understand. But, you know, so anyway, this phenomenon of craving. And he goes on. He says, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And he goes right at the bottom of that paragraph. I mean, this is all worth reading, but at the bottom of that paragraph, of that page. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that is my analogy for food. The sensation is so elusive, like it runs away, you can't really put a finger on it. That while they admit it is injurious, while they admit it hurts them, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. For months, I knew I was falling in love with my wife, but I thought she was really weird about food. And I thought, I don't know, if she doesn't enjoy food, what kind of a human being is she? I just had, you know, I thought, because my eating life was the normal one for me. And in my family, it was the normal one. More. And then comes words which I are so important. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, right at the bottom of that page, unless they can again experience, next page, the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that sense of ease and comfort comes in a person with the allergy, with that cravings. Because normal people, if they eat too much, get a feeling of unease and discomfort. Whereas if you're like me, at a certain point, it may not happen every time, but there are times in your life, if you're like me, when you get a sense, even stuffed to the gills, that you're home when you have some more. You get this ease and comfort. It relieves the itch, as it were. And just if you turn the, and right at the bottom of that page, he says, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. Turn the page, page XXX in the fourth edition, XXVIII, 28, the third. This page talks about all the kinds of alcoholics there are. He talks about the psychopaths, the person in denial, the manic depressive, the person who thinks he can easily take some if he's been free of it for a long time. And then he says the kinds that are normal. Able, intelligent, friendly people. Then he says there's only one thing they have in common, about two-thirds of the way down the page. All these and many others have one symptom in common. Like they don't have anything in common except one symptom. What is that? They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon, the unexplained occurrence of craving. That's what they have in common. They get cravings and normal people don't. And I wouldn't accept that for 7 years, but when I started studying with my friend, I finally said, I'm accepting that. I'm going to accept that. It says this phenomenon, this unexplained occurrence, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation, the showing of an allergy which differentiates these people, which sets them apart as a distinct entity, as a distinct group. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated, gotten rid of. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This paragraph has a very important role to play in the history of Overeaters Anonymous. Roseanne talks about it in her history of OA called Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. For 2 years, OA was founded in January of 1960. For 2 years, as Roseanne describes it, there were diets in OA. Some of them followed the popular weight loss program that I was part of. Some of them followed what was then known as blue sheet or orange sheet and became known as gray sheet. Some followed other forms of diets. And Roseanne had sort of understood the 12 steps through Gamblers Anonymous, not through Alcoholics Anonymous. The founder of Gamblers Anonymous helped her with founding OA. But she went to an open AA meeting at which they read this paragraph. I guess the whole of the doctor's opinion, but this paragraph specifically. And she suddenly had a brainstorm, and she wrote a letter to the 15 groups that existed at that time. I think 15 groups at that time. Said, we have not had a definition of sobriety in our program, and we need one. And let's call it abstinence, because that's what this is. And abstinence is abstaining from compulsive eating. And she then brought forward the notion that in between our moderate meals, we shouldn't be eating. Which is now known as the 301. Three meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time. And that met with a lot of resistance, but the idea of abstinence did not, as I understand it. People agreed that abstinence was a concept that was needed in OA, and that's what this paragraph gave us. We've come a long way in OA. A lot of battles and difficulties about looking at what abstinence is. But right now, abstinence is I would say, defined in the statement we have on abstinence by the group conscience of the World Service, a business conference of, I can't remember the year, 2014 or something like that. And it was read in our invitation to you. As far as I can remember it, it's something like this. Abstinence is the action of refraining from compulsive eating and eating behaviors while working towards and maintaining a healthy body weight. Okay? In other words, if you are not working towards a healthy body weight or at a healthy body weight, which could be either more than you weigh now or less than you weigh now, depending on whether you're overeating or undereating, then you are not abstinent, according to the group conscience of OA. But how you reach that is something that I want to spend some time on. The group conscience of OA in that pamphlet, Dignity of Choice, passed by the World Service Business Conference in 2004, says this. I'm not quoting it exactly, but it says that we each have to find our own things to and method of abstaining. We have to find it individually. And having someone else tell us what it should be may not be right for us. My experience is that while there's a lot of overlap within OA, I can eat things that other people in this room cannot, and other people can eat things that I cannot. One of my mentors in this program has no problem having a pat of butter if he goes out to eat on a roll. I can eat a roll. I can't eat butter. I just can't do it. Well, I've turned vegan, so now I don't eat it. But when I wasn't vegan, I couldn't eat butter. Butter fats are more difficult for me, just me, than oil fats, than vegetable oil fats. Just me. And other people can, other people say, I can't eat buns, so we each, the group conscience of OA, we have to figure it out ourselves. That's not easy. But do remember that the alcoholic must drink but cannot drink alcohol. We must eat, but we can't eat the foods that cause us cravings. And the other thing that we can't do is indulge in eating behaviors that cause us cravings. I just want to quote from the OA 12 and 12, the second edition, and I believe it's pages 2 and 3. The reason I say I believe it, I have a Kindle version. I didn't bring my hard copy. It says, whatever the cause, today we are not like normal people when it comes to food and eating behaviors. Like compulsive overeaters, normal eaters sometimes find pleasure and escape from life's problems in excess food. A normal eater, however, gets full and loses interest in food. Compulsive eaters often have an abnormal reaction to food. Some of us overindulge and can't quit, and then we crave more. Sometimes the craving is for a particular food. We feel compelled to eat another serving after we've finished the first, and then another and another. Other compulsive eaters indulge in the illusion of control through restricting food intake. Some of us purge after eating in an effort to control our weight. What all compulsive eaters have in common is that our bodies and minds seem to send us signals about food that are quite different from those the normal eater receives. We have found through much experience that no matter how long we abstain from eating compulsively, and no matter how adept, how able we become at facing life, we will always have these normal tendencies. Clearly, if we are to live free of the bondage of compulsive eating, we must abstain from all foods and eating behaviors that cause us to eat compulsively. Okay? I'll tell you my story, and then I'll talk about what I do with sponsees. I read the big book, the doctor's opinion, with my friend Eddie, who had really, really read the big book. The alcoholic who joined OA. And he said, I know what I can't eat. I can't eat fast foods. I can't eat cheeseburgers. I can't eat pizzas. I'm just going to stop eating fast foods. And he stopped eating fast foods and he lost a lot of weight and he was happy. He worked the steps. I knew I couldn't eat most fast foods, but I decided to make a list of my binge foods. I made up that list. And it included, almost all desserts. And in particular, cheesecake, shortbread, and ice cream, which I've eaten boxes of shortbread and whole cheesecakes and tubs of ice cream. It always seemed to me that shortbread was the answer to the question, how little flour do you need to mix sugar and fat together, sugar and butter together? And then I discovered toffee, which is... It's a real answer because you don't need butter at all. But anyway, pardon me for salivating. Just kidding. But on the other hand, there was buttered popcorn, goose fat, the skins of, deep fried foods, all the French fries and all the, deep fried chicken and all those things, which had nothing to do with sweet, had everything to do with salt and fat. So I looked at that and I said, obviously I have to stop eating my binge foods. Obviously I have to stop eating the foods I have binged on. But there seems to be a common ingredient to the foods that I've binged on, and that is a combination of fat with sugar, high fat with sugar, and high fat with salt. And if you looked at the ingredients of some fast foods, you'll find that into the salty fat foods, a little bit of sugar is put, and into the sugary fat foods, a little bit of salt is put. This whole combination, there's a whole book been written on that, but that's neither here nor there. And so I worked out sort of a formula of how much fat per serving I would take in. It doesn't matter what I worked out, but I would cut away all visible fats from meats. I would not eat cheese other than as a slight sprinkling for flavor. I wouldn't have any high-fat dairy products. I wouldn't have anything deep fried. I wouldn't have any visible fats of any kind. And if given a choice between a low fat and no fat, I would choose no fat. So given a choice between 1% and skim milk, I'd choose skim milk. And I did that. And I worked the steps. And by the time I finished step 9, in a big book way, and I didn't want to return to any of those things. But I was still heavy. And my friend had lost weight. And my friend and I said, how can I carry a message of recovery if I haven't lost the weight? What kind of a model am I? Well, clearly there was some volume issue in there because I was eating healthy foods. I was not eating foods that caused me to want more. It caused me these cravings. And a couple of things happened. I won't go into any detail, don't have to, but one of the things was I read from the first edition of the OA 12 and 12 where the concept of abstaining from compulsive eating and eating behaviors really struck me. I began to realize I had certain eating behaviors I had to abstain from. I had the eating behavior that I got from the popular weight loss program I had been on, of eating all the time. Free foods, celery, hot air popcorn, gum, chewing. Keep your mouth busy, said this popular weight loss program, because it takes your mind off eating calories. So I was eating all the time. And what I found was eating all the time, keeping my mouth chewing all the time, meant that I was eating more, I was salivating more, and I was sort of hungrier isn't the word, but I wanted more volume in the healthy foods I was eating. That was one thing, obvious. So I went back to what I first did in OA, 3 meals a day, nothing in between, a day at a time. I don't eat between meals. And I've kept that up too. I also said I have to stop eating at a point where I can lose weight. So I developed this concept that worked for me for a very long time, which was that I would eat up to my belly button instead of up to my neck. And this made sense to me, even though it took me about 10 years before I was giving a talk on this, and a nurse came up to me and said, you do realize that the stomach starts at the belly button. It doesn't, it's not in between, you know. So I don't know what it means, but whatever it is, I knew the difference between sort of being full up to approximately where my stomach is and being full up to my neck. And I had been eating up to my neck, in the sense, healthy foods, but eating too much of it. So I stopped when I was full in the normal sense, and that I lost a lot of weight just doing eliminating those two things. I must tell you that as I get older, and as they say, things go south, I'm not sure that that's continuing to work for me. I'm 15 pounds lighter than I was when I was last here in 2004, but there's still more weight that I think I want to lose, and I'm not sure this feeling of being full is working for me. I think I have to adopt even more restrictions on what I take into my body. So I want to tell you that all these things are things that we have to work out and be honest with ourselves about. I'm being honest, as honest as I can with you, about me. I can tell you that at times I eat more when I read, or I eat more when I watch TV. I find my mind just is not concentrating on how full I really am. Now, it has been deleterious. My doctor's basically happy with my weight. I'm at a basically healthy body weight. But I could be losing more, and I'd like to lose more. And I think as time goes on, my metabolism is going to be lower, and that and the amount of food that I'm used to eating is going to be too much for me. Over a period of time, I've added foods that I can't eat. I discovered fake ice cream made with skim milk and frozen blueberries. Tastes just like ice cream. I can't eat it because it tastes just like ice cream, even though it's healthy. You know, and blueberries, antioxidants, and, you know, skim milk, no fat, a lot of protein. Can't eat it. Hot air popcorn, can't eat it. It satisfies some gnawing urge in me, it just creates this problem. I was eating, at one of my three meals, I was eating more popcorn than everything else. I was getting full and stopping, but it was the popcorn that was filling me and not the other foods. Nothing wrong with hot air popcorn. It's very low fat. It's high fiber. Nothing wrong with it, but I had to quit because I wanted it so much. I found a rice cracker. I have no idea what kind of rice cracker it is. It didn't have fat in it. It didn't have sugar in it. But somehow it had a taste that just made me want more. So I stopped eating it. And it wasn't hard. So as time goes on, I test these things out. And I stop eating them as they need be. Now, when I work with a sponsee, I say, make a list of foods that you think you'll never be able to do without. That sort of hits them in the eye, between the eyes, you know. Make a list of the foods that you can't imagine not eating for the rest of your life. Make a list of the foods that you have binged on, that you have wanted to stop eating and haven't been able to, or that you found yourself eating so much of and not really realizing you had eaten all of it, or so much of it. I also suggest that they make a distinction between the diet that they choose to be on and the things that they have to abstain from. There are a lot of diets that are heard of in OA. People adopt paleo and keto and sugar and flour and gluten-free and GI and, there's blood and there's, I don't know what, all these things. Some of them are fads. Some of them may be based on science. I don't care. I'm vegan. It has nothing to do with OA. I'm just vegan by my choice. That's my diet. That's the context in which I work out what I'm going to abstain from. But just to say I'm going keto, that may be a diet for losing weight, but that's not abstaining from the foods and or compulsive behaviors that may cause you cravings. That's not doing the analysis. Or my sponsor told me to stop eating sugar and flour. That's not doing the analysis, your analysis of your issue. Because I will say to anyone who says I'm sugar and flour free, that's what I have to abstain from, I will ask that person, have you ever eaten a whole bag of sugar? I've only met one person who's ever said yes to that. There may be some in this room, but I don't know many people who have ever eaten a whole bag of sugar. Have you ever eaten a whole bag of flour?
No.
Have you ever been so taken by the flower that you had to eat it? And the answer, of course, is no. Therefore, clearly, it's what you're mixing the flour and the sugar with. And I had a conversation years ago with someone who said, you know, I've been abstinent from sugar for a long time. I haven't lost any weight. Why? I said, well, name me a binge food. She said, donuts. I said, well, you know, there is... So I know. I said, ever eaten a bag of sugar? Nah. Ever eaten a bag of flour? No. No, ever eaten a bag of sugar? No. Name me a binge food. Donuts. I said, you know, there is another ingredient in donuts. She said, yes, you're right. Flour. How could I have missed that? I can't eat any flour. I said, ever eaten a bag of flour? No. I said, well, you know, there's another ingredient in donuts. She looked at me with these wide eyes. What? I said, donuts are deep fried fat. She walked away. And I've met people in OA who have been sugar free and flour free, and they're at a restaurant or an OA dinner, and the waiter comes with a bun. Oh, take it away. Can't have flour at the table. And then they bring the potato. Would you like some butter with the potato? Oh, sure. Would you like bacon bits? Oh, sure. Would you like sour cream? Oh, sure. Lay it on. And there are people who aren't visibly at a healthy body weight and have been the same body weight for the 5 or 10 years I've known them. And I don't say it's only fat. A lot of you might be able to eat fat. It's not up to me to tell you that your problem is fat. My problem is fat. But I'm not saying yours is. It may be only sugar. It may be only flour. It may be gluten. Who knows? But you have to know and be honest with yourself about the problem. And then you have to look at eating behaviors. What are the things that just get you going? Do you eat at night? Stop eating at night. Right? Do you eat while you're reading? Stop eating while reading. Stop reading while eating. You know? Do you eat when you're emotional? Avoid emotional times. Do you eat only at your mother's place? Stop going to your mother. You know, I'm throwing this out, but I might be able to answer a question, but not easily. Okay. And you might say, well, how do I stop? I mean, I'll tell you, how do you stop? And I say to my sponsees, you not only have to develop a plan of eating, you have two other plans you have to develop while you're working the steps. The first is a plan of eating that you're honest about. You may add to it as time goes on. You may even have some of the foods that you've decided to abstain from. You may, after you reach step 9, after you recover, do a further analysis and say, that wasn't a food. That is a food I can try to eat in moderation. It's not up to me. But there are two other plans you need. One is a sense of how long it's going to take you to work the steps. Because if you know that you just have to hang on for 2 months and then you won't want this stuff, 2 months is something you can handle. We've all dieted for a month or 2 months or 3 months. So give yourself a sense, I'm going to finish the steps as quickly as I can. So give yourself a timetable and say, I'm going to hang on for this amount. I'll do whatever. And then the third plan is, do whatever it takes. Figure out a strategy for dealing with the day-to-day temptations. Phone someone. Phone in your food. Text your food. Say, I'm going to drink. I will eat this food after I take 8 ounces of water and wait 20 minutes. You know, and then I can have it. I mean, that's one suggestion people have had. I'm going to write down. I will read literature. I will go to meetings. I will leave the place I'm in. I will throw it out of my house until I feel comfortable with having it in my house. I mean, all these things. I will avoid certain situations while I am working the steps, because I got to be abstinent while I'm working the steps. So I don't have an easy answer. But what I do know is this. If you are honest with yourself, and it's always best to do it with some cynical or skeptical, not necessarily cynical, skeptical and experienced OA member who can sort of cross-examine you about, is that it? Isn't there a little bit more? Is there a common ingredient? Are there a few common ingredients? You know, what is really going on? What are you avoiding? Are you not telling me something? Is there one food there that you're really keeping? Why do you need that comfort food at night? Or what do you need a snack for? You don't think you have enough fat on your body to feed you for the rest of the day? The rest of the day? Well, really. I mean, think about it. How do you lose weight? Your body eats the fat. Your body is deprived and eats your fat. Uses your fat to produce the whatever it needs, the energy that it needs. So if you're fat, especially if you're fat, obviously you eat less than your body needs. I remember Roseanne talked about her doctor who spoke in a Texan accent, which I can't do, but something like, honey, it's a matter of arithmetic. If you take in more food than your body needs, you gain weight. If you take in less food than your body needs, you lose weight. It's pretty simple. So, and it's appropriate time for me to end just with this. So I'll pick this up tomorrow, and tomorrow I'll also talk about the other element, this mental obsession that the doctor isolated. We'll be reading the rest of the book. I'm available to anyone who wants to talk about a plan of eating. I'm happy to cross-examine them if they want to do it. Maybe because it's such a large audience, questions and answers from the floor make it very hard. But could we have maybe tomorrow an Ask It basket where people could write questions? Because I would then get a real sense of whether I'm making myself clear, making things clear and answering any questions or anything you disagree with. You write it down and I'll be happy to respond to it. Just to give you an overview. Steps 1 and 2, we'll be talking about basically, I talked about today, and I'll talk about tomorrow. From the big book perspective, we'll whiz through Bill's story, we'll talk about there is a solution and more about alcoholism, that's step 1. Step 2, I will pay special attention to the atheist and the agnostic because I am a person who does not believe in any kind of God. I believe I'm an agnostic because although I don't believe in it, I don't know that for sure, but whatever it is, I will tell you why, even if you are a deeply religious person, you should be reading the chapter We Agnostics. It contains a message for you as well as for agnostics and atheists like me. So that's step 2. Then we will read the chapter How It Works, where we will discuss the understanding of what it means to turn your will and your life over to the care of God and how to do it. We'll find out it's just a simple prayer. It's just a decision, nothing more. Then we'll go on to step 4. That'll be in the morning. And then in the afternoon will be step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and I think 10. And then Sunday will be step 11, relatively briefly, and step 12 in more detail. We will pass out tomorrow a number of forms that will show you, first of all, if I can just indulge me for one more minute, please. I know my time is up. One is called a schematic outline of the big book. And basically it's a way of trying to show you the subtitles that aren't there. Where does one section begin and another section end? Another section begin. Just to help you understand the construction of the big book. Another one will be a checklist of promises. Every promise that the big book gives is like a checklist. If I don't feel this, I haven't done the step right. There's more work to be done on that step. I'll show you that as we go on. And then there are forms for doing step 4 and steps 8 and 9. And step 11, all the prayers that you need to say, all the meditations are on one page for you. So we'll be passing those out. And that's it. Thank you. See you tomorrow.